On this edition of On the Mark with yours truly, Mark Carmen. Yes, David Ross has been hired, and the new skipper for the Chicago Cubs joins me on the program. Second part today, that's right, former NBA referee Tim Donaghy has a movie out. It's called Inside Game, and it details his stories in the NBA, how he got banned from the NBA, and Tim's going to tell us a story about Dennis Rodman and herpes that you won't want to miss. On the Mark with yours truly, Mark Carmen, starts right now. Up first, the Cubs' new manager, David Ross.
So I talked to you. You were promoting diapers on September the 18th, and I'm like, well, I got to ask David Ross, does he have interest? And then I was surprised and interested, like, that it was clear that you did. So I'm just rewinding back. Did you know that this was coming down the pipe? Or you see a possibility? What would you say about looking back?
I just think, you know, in the roles I've had, and especially with the TV stuff, being in these different locker rooms and a lot of conversations with really close friends, Aaron Boone, Kevin Cash, as I pass through, Alex Cora, Dave Roberts, they're all ex-teammates of mine. And so I've just kind of inquired about it. You know, my name's been thrown out there the last couple of years with some different jobs. And, you know, you start asking yourself that question a little more. The more it gets in the media, the more people start talking about it, you start to kind of figure. And then, you know, you ask me, it's like, this organization is obviously means a lot to me. And so my heart is drawn to that dugout when I come here. I've wanted to be back in that dugout just in some capacity for a long, long time. But, you know, I trying to balance a lot of, you know, family stuff and job stuff. And so, when this came available, I mean, who turns down this job? Like, what? Yeah, everybody be calling me an idiot.
See, people were saying, no, Ross is, I'm like, really? He wouldn't be interested in managing the Chicago Cubs? That doesn't make sense to me. And there you go.
Yeah, it doesn't make a lot of sense. Yeah, it's just like Theo's like, can you come in? And yes, sir. Let me know when you need me. And I tell you what, that phone call from him and telling me I got the job was just, I was over the moon, emotional, super excited. There's not a more iconic, you know, you get a chance to lead one of the most iconic organizations in all of pro sports in the world. You know, you don't turn that down, and you take it very seriously. And it's a huge honor, and I know there's a lot of expectations, and I'm up for the challenge. I'm excited.
Was there any question in the interview process where, like, uh-oh, I might have messed up that one?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's in the interview process, there's, like, some areas where you're like, oh, I killed that. I nailed it. Like, you know, feel like it felt awesome, top of the world. And there's some you're just like, man, I hadn't thought about it like that or hadn't seen the game that way. And so, yeah, just a lot of those things, the analytical side, just knowing, yeah, that's the stuff I'm going to dive into as soon as I'm done here, just getting to know as much as I can from the analytical side, stuff I thought I knew, but there's just some deeper things that I got to get a grasp on.
So you mentioned in the press conference about Grandpa Rossi and all that. You're a kind of a made man in town. You won a World Series here, and in some ways you're putting that on the line because, you know, I can look at, like, John Paxson for the Bulls. He had a game-winning shot in the 93 finals. Gets a lot of flack now, so it's a different guy. So, but you're not about that, I'm guessing?
Yeah, I mean, I thought about that. I mean, like, I roll into this town, and they treat me like king, and I understand that that's going to change, you know, unless you put another trophy up or multiple trophies. So, you know, I understand that, and that's part of it going in. But my passion isn't, you know, fame or you know, coming and getting free dinners in Chicago. It's about people, and it's about winning championships, and I've been a part of history twice, and it's a special, special thing that you can't ever replace. And having a chance to lead men to do something special that's historic is where my heart lies.
And it's not just the winning, though, too, right? You enjoy the actual process.
Yeah, it's a grind. I mean, it's the ups and downs. You know, like problem solving, how to figure it out, what's going wrong. Just constantly a passion for success, I think, is what drives you. You know, it's funny as players and especially in a manager, like, the wins are expected and the losses are what kill you, right? And so I've seen that. I've seen it on my friends that are managers, and we've talked about it. So, but that's the way we're wired. It's the way I'm wired. You're trying to fix the losses and just kind of, okay, we won that one, on to the next one.
Have you thought about, you know, after a game I go 0-4, how I shook that off versus how do I, we lost and this decision, that decision, this guy's struggling. Like, you could drive yourself nuts till 4 a.m.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of managers do lose sleep, right? Yeah. But I'm gonna rely heavily on my coaches with a lot of that. I want my coaches to hold me accountable. I want to tell me the truth of where I make mistakes. I'm gonna make some. I don't have all the answers. It's a collaborative thing for me. At the end of the day, I make the final decision, but I'm gonna rely heavily on the front office and the coaches and even the players, the feedback from the players, the guys I have a relationship with. Just a lot of open, honest conversations.
Realistic expectations for 2020, how you're looking at it right now?
World Series, right? Like, I mean, I want to win the World Series. We got the talents there. There ain't no doubt about it. There's a lot of talent on that field. I'll never not put my eye on the biggest goal, and that's winning World Series. I learned that early on in my career. Why ever settle for anything less? It's not about making the playoffs. It's about hanging banners and winning trophies. That's the stuff I came back for, and that's what I'm passionate about.
Last one. Have you reached out to John and or Anthony, who, like, are you got a smile on your face right now, like, I'm going to go out to the mound, I'm going to take you out, dude, and you're probably not going to like it.
I told John, I'm coming to get the ball from you. Don't you show me up in front of all these people, jokingly, right? Yeah, man, we've had some conversations. I told him I'd reach out a little more. They had a lot of questions. They've both been calling me Skipper over text messaging, which makes me laugh a little bit and smile all at the same time. I'm in a different role, but those relationships are going to go a long way. I'm going to lean on those guys that I know well, the Hobbies, the Lesters, the Riz, the KBs, these guys that I know really well, to give me just some honest feedback about how I'm doing sometimes, and then I'm going to give them some honest feedback about what I expect from them and their effort on a daily basis.
And for real, last one. This team, there's a lot of conversations around Chicago's, if they don't win another World Series, will it be a disappointment? And I remember walking around Wrigley when you guys just won the pennant. And I remember interviewing you on the field that night. People were crying. I'm like, is this the best night of your life? Yes. Have you had kids? Yes. So, I mean, in my mind, it's a success no matter what. But how do you look at that part of it?
Yeah, I mean, expectation winning brings even more expectations, right? So, but that's a good thing. Expectations, as Joe used to say, a guy I'll pull a lot of kind of my things from, and it was a huge influence on me. Winning expectations are a great thing, and I don't want to be in a place that I have high expectations. So yes, that's why we're here. We're here to win more championships. The Ricketts want more. The front office wants more. Theo and Jed, they're going to hold each other, all of us, to that standard. And I think if you ask these players, that's what they want. That's the game changer. That's the stuff that is historic, and that you go back to those amazing memories of the grind of a season and all the good and bad that's going to come throughout the season, but then you get to hold up that trophy at the end. That's what it's all about.
Congrats, man. Great to see you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark.
Before we get to Tim Donaghy, let's talk with the Cubs president, Theo Epstein. And yes, you just heard from David Ross. I think he's going to do great. He certainly has the media part down. He's awesome to talk to, and he seems like a great guy. And I think the Cubs, their players specifically, are going to love him, the fans as well. But let's hear from Theo. Why, Theo Epstein, was David Ross the choice?
In the end, I think we came back to that, David's special gifts as a leader, the things you just can't teach. He excels at so much. And already has a head start on learning the things that he needs to get up to speed on as a manager, that we feel like in short time will grow into being, a special manager. He's just, those natural leadership skills, the communication skills, the ability to tell players things they don't necessarily want to hear, but still have the magnetism to keep them coming back for more. It's easy to get in a player's face. Anyone can do that. It's hard to get in their face and then have them come back half an hour later and, want to talk about it more and still want to be around you. He's just got that special gift where he can be engaging and develop close bonds while also holding guys accountable. It's not easy.
Fair enough. Makes sense. So what was the problem with Joe Maddon, who won a World Series? I'm not going to go through his entire resume. I'm a huge Joe Maddon fan. But there was something when you watch the Cubs play that just felt off. And I would kind of call it a deadness. Satisfied, won the World Series, not nearly as motivated. So that did come out talking to Theo yesterday as he detailed how the Cubs really were a team, at least before the game, and a lot of guys expressing this, I guess, on their exit interviews, which you're about to hear, that they really weren't together.
That was an observation that David had as well, and I was glad because we shared those thoughts, especially after it was so prominently expressed in the exit interview. The guys felt there wasn't enough team bonding off the field to begin with, but then on while we're at work, you know, our guys' routines have evolved to be so individual that there just wasn't much time when we were actually together as a team, either, you know, practicing on the field or, you know, together talking strategy, talking baseball. So I think that it's going to be a priority going forward just to try to rebuild some togetherness and make sure those special bonds get created, that we work together and hopefully we play together as well.
Interesting, right? They're professional baseball players. This is not a high school team. You wouldn't think that team bonding, so to speak, is needed. But apparently it is. And that's one of the things, by the way, that Joe Maddon would do. He'd have the road trips, the put on the jersey, wear the animal outfits, bring in the flamingo, something to bring the guys together. But maybe after a period of time, that just gets a little old. And perhaps guys obviously got complacent. So David Ross is probably going to do this in a more old school way. I wouldn't expect flamingos or whatever. But as far as getting guys together, it's something he noticed. Theo agrees with it. The players are talking about it. So that'll be something different for the Cubs in 2020. I do think you need some players to add into that mix to sort of boil it all together, that it will really feel different. You're not going to change the personalities of who's in there. So they need kind of a David Ross type, at least in my mind, as a player to join into the mix to sort of bring that camaraderie together. Maybe somebody who wants to actually talk baseball after the game. Here is Theo on Ross's leadership skills and how he challenges guys.
He'd be the guy telling players what they needed to hear, not what they wanted to hear, and they would still keep coming back with bonds of friendship and bonds as teammates and brothers. So, you know, I think after talking to a few of our players, I think some of them are rooting for somebody else just so they, you know, they make it a little bit easier road for them. But it's not high on a list of concerns. And honestly, at this point, you're talking, what, eight or so guys, maybe a couple more, depending on how things shake out. And then you know, baseball keeps moving forward. So there's going to be a point where, you know, he's got all, you know, no former teammates that he's working with at some point.
You got to love that. And I trust it. I think it's clear that Theo loves this guy, and I think he knows what he's doing. And quite frankly, by the way, I was sold on David Ross a long time ago when everyone else was. The Cubs won the World Series, and that was the biggest game, obviously, in franchise history, and it was in Game 7 on the road, which I'm sure you remember. But they won the pennant at home in 6 games over the Dodgers, and I've never seen Wrigley Field like that, ever. I was walking through the crowd. People are crying. I'm interviewing fans. Is this the greatest day of your life? Yes. Do you have kids? Yes. Is this better than having kids? Yes. And the players are out on the field celebrating. And, of course, David Ross was one of those guys. So I thought it'd be nice just to look back and go back to that night. Cubs beat the Dodgers. And this was Ross on the field.
With David Ross, watching you on stage and see the emotions well up, man, that's big time. It was just so cool.
The love, the cheer. I mean, when you got 45, 50,000 people cheering for you when they announce your name on stage, it's just, it doesn't get any better than that. And I don't know. I love it. I don't know why they do it. They treat me so good. You know, it's so nice to hear that. It warms my heart. It just fills me up with joy and makes me so emotional because, you know, I'm a backup catcher and a guy that just tries to contribute to the team and works hard and do my part. And these guys treat me with a lot of respect and fans give me a lot of love. And it just is, it's overwhelming.
Well, the city is about hard work and they love team guys and they see that in you. I mean, you don't have to really figure it out more than that. That's the love right there. And you perform pretty well, too.
Well, you know, yeah, playing well always helps, you know. But, yeah, the success here with this group and being on this stage and, you know, all the love you get from these fans, it's just, I'm so happy for them and being in this environment. Great energy tonight at the stadium. Coming in today, you could just feel the buzz in the city. Walking around, I was getting a coffee this morning, and you could just feel the buzz. Everybody excited, tapping me, telling me good luck, and You just feel the love all the way around the city, everywhere I go. And there's good people here. There's good quality values in here. And it's nice for me to be able to end my career here with my family. It's a real special moment tonight.
Last one for you. WGN-TV is lurking on me. I see you, Dan Rohn. So when did you know that this group could do what you've done at this point and hopefully four more?
I think last year we grew into the winner that you saw, you know, and being able to do what we did last year. And guys continue to work hard in the offseason and all the way through spring training. And it's been our goal to get to this point and win a World Series. And now we're going. We have that chance. So it's a credit to the coaching staff and the front office for spending the money and the ownership. And the whole group will continue to get better and work hard toward this goal. And you don't see a lot of teams that you know, set their goals as high as we do and are able to reach them. So we're on our way there, and we got one more step.
David Ross, the city loves you. You'll never have to buy dinner here. Congratulations.
Thanks for having me.
One of the greatest nights in Cub baseball history. All right, we move on. Let us bring in the conversation with Tim Donaghy, 52 years old now, banned from the NBA, cheated on games, provided information, and he's got a movie out. Here comes the former ref, Tim Donaghy, on the Mark with yours truly, Mark Harmon. It is my pleasure to bring in Tim Donaghy, NBA ref from 1994 to 2007. And of course, Tim was involved in the NBA's gambling scandal in the mid-2000s. Tim was providing information to gamblers, ended up getting caught, and has been banned from the NBA. He's now has a movie that is about him called Inside Game, and Tim joining us now. Tim, this movie is going to detail in depth what you did in the NBA, going to perhaps expose you to people who don't know your story. This has to feel super vulnerable. This movie is going to be out there with yourself and your dad and a lot of people you know. How's it feeling for you knowing that people are going to see sort of the inside part of the story in Inside Game?
You know, obviously, you know, when I was going through the whole situation in 2007, it was very embarrassing, and it is still as embarrassing 10 years later to see it play out in the movie Inside Game. So it's a situation where a lot of poor choices are shown in the movie that I made. But hopefully something positive is going to come from that, and that a lot of people are going to learn from it. So it's an exciting time to see the movie, but in the same sense, it's a little embarrassing.
Tim, where did the muscle come from for you to continue to do these interviews and sort of, I guess, relive it all the time? Because you've been on a ton of radio, and you're talking to me today, and we're going to hit some different points in the conversation, hopefully. But this is something that you do all the time, and it can't be easy.
You know, I think that, you know, I don't like to put, you know, any, you know, stop buttons in any interviews that I do. I think if I can, you know, let people know, you know, in an honest way what I did and how I did it, and the transparency, you know, helps, you know, have people forgive you. And, you know, I'm very fortunate that we live in a very, you know, forgiving society, and people have been very nice to me, even though that I really did some dumb things and made some poor choices. So with that being said, you know, I think it's a situation, especially in the movie Inside Game, where you can see that those poor choices not only affected me, but the people that I love the most, and that's my family, and we can all learn from it.
Yeah, so you've got four daughters, correct, Tim?
Yes.
So, and how old were they at the time when this was all coming apart in 2007?
Yeah, 13, 14, you know, 7 and 9. So, you know, they were young.
Okay. And what was the conversation that you were having with your family at the time?
You know, basically that I made some poor choices. I made some mistakes, and I was going to have to pay for that. I was going to have to pay for it by losing my job, and not only losing my job, you know, going away for a 15-month jail sentence. So, you know, my kids were very understanding, very forgiving. I'm very fortunate that I've been able to rebuild my life with the help of family and friends, and my youngest daughter has been living with me full-time for the last 8 years.
Wow. I would think, though, that, I don't know, if I was your kid, Tim, I'd be like, Dad, why did you do that? Why are you leaving me? I mean, were you having those kind of conversations?
For sure, and it was extremely difficult. I remember when I was in prison and my daughters came for a visit, and when it was time to leave, the youngest one ran, jumped up in my arms, and gave me the biggest, strongest hug and told me that she wasn't going to leave, that she was going to stay there with me.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, it was definitely heart-wrenching at the time. And even when I think back about that day, it gets me a little emotional.
Yeah. Well, time heals all wounds, so to speak, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me bring up the name Jimmy Batista. If you – how much of you meeting Jimmy – not that you're putting it on him or anyone in particular. You make your own choices in life. I think everybody knows that. But how much did that friendship end up impacting your life in a negative way?
Well, he wasn't really a friend. He was an associate of the Gambino crime family that happened to go to the same high school with me. My friend was Tommy Martino, who knew him also. He kind of tricked Tommy into setting up a meeting between the three of us. And with that being said, you know, he was the guy that was moving a lot of money. He was a guy that was in debt to a lot of people. He was betting hundreds of thousands of dollars on each one of these plays and giving information to the Gambino crime family. And eventually it was heard over a Gambino wiretap, and that's how the whole thing was exposed.
Right, right. So, and then, okay, they get word, you're on tape. What went down when they approached you?
The FBI agents?
Yeah.
Yeah, what happened was is Tommy had called me and said the FBI had been at his house for 3 days asking him questions. And, you know, with that being said, I went to an attorney because I knew it was about me. In the next 30 days, I lost 30 pounds. Like, I couldn't eat or drink anything. And the stress was just enormous on my life. I knew I was in a lot of trouble. I had an attorney call, the United States attorney that was working the case. And he basically said, you know, you tell Tim Dunne, I know what you did. I know who you did it with. You're going to lose your job. But if you don't come to us and work with us, not only are you going to lose your job, but you're going to go to jail for a long, long time. And with that threat, I got on the plane the next day and went to New York and sat down with the FBI agents and told them what I did and how I did it.
And you maintain to this day, Tim, that, and I believe you, by the way, for the record here, but you maintain you did not fix games. You just had access to information. Is that correct?
Yes, and even the FBI and the NBA concluded that I didn't go out and fix games. And what I mean by that is putting stars to the bench and making up fouls to make sure a bet won. The only thing I did was within the scope of the rule book, you know, I may have targeted certain players with that crew that night and, you know, called violations on them. Maybe were let go in previous games. But for whatever reason, we were going to enforce them strictly that night because maybe of a vendetta between a referee and a player that we were going to enforce.
So you and your fellow officials would go out before the game and be like, if X player, I don't know who we're talking about here, Tim Duncan, Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, if he does this particular move, we're going to call it. Is that how those conversations would go?
Yes, it was Allen Iverson who had threatened Steve Javy the game before, and we all felt as a staff that he should have been suspended, and he was only fined $20,000. I had the next game, and the two officials I was working with and myself decided that we were going to go out and call palming violations on him, even though he got away with that you know, his whole career. And we went out in the first half, called three palming violations on him, and he came up to me and said, you know, hey, Tim, how long is this going to last for? And I basically told him, I don't know what you're talking about, Alan. And he laughed and looked at me and he said, you know what I'm talking about. And I kind of laughed back at him. So it was just a matter of time that he was going to be scrutinized because of the fact that he had threatened to kill one of our coworkers.
And who did he threaten again?
He threatened Steve Javy,
right,
who was one of the top officials at the time.
Right. And why was he threatening Steve Javy?
Because Javy just had an ongoing battle with him every time he officiated him. So Allen had enough, and I think Steve was, you know, giving him technical fouls or throwing him out of the game. And as he was walking off the court, he told him that, you know, he was going to kill him. And basically, you know, it was something that we felt that he should have been suspended for, and he was only fined.
So why doesn't the league's got to know that this is going on? Why do they not get involved on with you guys, the referees, or with the players? You know, Joey Crawford had a long time thing going on with Tim Duncan and the Spurs, and yet he would pop up and he'd be refereeing a Spur game. Like, that never added up to me.
No, and I think now that they really make sure that the animosity between referees and players either gets settled or the referees are held, you know, off of their games. In the past, there were only 58 referees, so you would see the same team you know, maybe once, twice, three times a week, or even, you know, a couple times more that month. But now they have so many referees, they kind of don't allow the referees to see the same teams as often as they did in the past.
Okay. All right, let me rewind back here. I want to ask a couple more questions on Jimmy Batista, who I was watching one of his videos, and he said that based on your information, you guys would have a code word, I guess it was Schmaga, which he would up your pay if you gave him some, like, really hot information where you were super confident about a game. Is that accurate?
Yes. Joey, we nicknamed him Schmaga, was a handicapped child that lived in the neighborhood of the Martinos that we always took out to lunch and really was a part of all our families 20-some years. So that was the words we used if the play was just, you know, so good that you know, he needed to bet everything he could on it. And we would just call it a Schmaga.
Tim, can you give me an example of a Schmaga game?
One time I was in Washington, and Mike Fratello was coaching the Memphis Grizzlies, and he was coming in for that game, and one of the team personnel saw him as he was getting off the bus, and Mike Fratello told him that he was sitting four of his five starters and basically was going to be a throw-in game for them the rest, and I knew Washington was going to win and win big, so you know, I called up Tommy Martino and told him that, you know, it's a schmogger. You know, Washington's going to win and cover, and they're going to win by 20 or 30 points. And with not explaining to him why, you know, he passed that information along to Batista, and they were able to capitalize on it.
It came in, huh? That was a winner?
Absolutely. We wanted a 85% clip. There was very few times where we had problems that we had a bet that lost.
And you would get, what, $5,000 for a regular game and a schmaga? Is that right? You get $200,000+?
No, I got $2,000 per correct play. The money was always a problem. I just wanted to be done with Batista. There was a lot of times where Tommy and I didn't even get paid because he was on drugs and he was doing online poker and he was losing millions of dollars doing things that he shouldn't have been doing. So the money really never came flowing back to us like it was supposed to.
Interesting. So did you have to pay back dough as well, Tim?
I had to pay back $30,000 to the government, which was the $30,000 that Tommy Martino had given me from the scheme.
Okay. Did you benefit financially overall, would you say?
I benefited, you know, the $30,000, and that's why I had to pay it back. And I think that was in a period of 3 months.
Okay. Okay. When you look back on it, Tim, how do you think you fell into this?
Just by making poor choices, hanging out with the wrong people, and crossing lines that I should not have even been near. So, you know, it really, in the movie Inside Game, that's what really comes out the most is, you know, how we really screwed up and made some poor choices. But because we had such strong families and parents and brothers and sisters, we were able to get through it and then had our family stand by us.
Yeah. You know, I'm just playing amateur psychologist here. I'm thinking to myself, like, okay, you've got this great position in life. You're an NBA referee, nearly impossible to get to. Here you are. You're refereeing Kobe Bryant, Michael Jordan. You got to be loving your life, you would think. But there's got to be maybe either some belief that you're either A, invincible, or B, you know, it's still not even good enough. Like, I need to impress people by driving an even fancier car. I'm trying to understand that part of it.
Oh, no doubt about it. A little bit of greed, a little bit of, thinking that you're invincible, as you said, and going out and just making poor decision after poor decision. You know, you're on the top of the world. You have a great job making more money than you ever dreamed of. So I tossed that all away. Because of, you know, my addiction to gambling and my need for that, juice of adrenaline from the gambling.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, it's almost the excitement of it, right? It's not even the money. It's more like the thrill of getting away with it. Is that accurate?
Oh, absolutely. It was definitely just I got that high from gambling, and whether it was on the golf course in Atlantic City or betting on NBA games, and it just started to consume my life.
Yeah. Yeah, 772 regular season games. You ref 20 in the playoffs. What do you miss about it the most?
You know, being on the floor in front of 20,000 people, running up and down the court with the greatest athletes in the world. So, you know, you're right there with all the stars. And you know, I watched it on TV, and I think to myself that should be me, and it's not. So it's difficult from time to time to really watch a game.
Yeah, how do you coach yourself to get through it. I mean, outside of, I mean, that's probably what I would do. I don't know if how much I could actually watch, but when you are watching, like, how do you sort of tell yourself, like, you know what, hey, this is my life right now, and you can't walk around with this because it's going to eat you up.
Right, and I have, you know, great kids that, you know, really lift me up during the course of the day, great parents. I'm very fortunate that I got involved in real estate. I got involved in, you know, refpicks.com and you know, this movie Inside Game, which is, you know, a great message. So I think it's going to really lead to some bigger and better things.
Do you enjoy doing these interviews, Tim, or is it kind of painful for you?
But to be honest with you, it's painful to a certain extent that to continue to relive it. It's the story that won't ever die because it's got all those things in it that people love. It's gambling, it's women, it's drugs, it's the mob, and you know, it's all portrayed and played out great in the movie, and that's why I think you know, people are going to really enjoy it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to watching it. Your dad, you know, is a Final Four official, which obviously helped you move along the referee ranks. Not saying you weren't incredibly qualified, Tim, but you know, it's such a competitive thing. You need that name recognition, and you had it. And I know that your dad has pushed you to say, hey, okay, whatever's in the future, you're going to be the best you can at that. But somebody who did actually do the job, was it more perhaps extra hard for him to digest what had gone on?
Oh, no doubt about it. I think it was very difficult for him once he really realized what I did and what I was involved in. But I have to give him a lot of credit. When I called him in 2007 on Father's Day to wish him a happy Father's Day, you know, he said to me within 30 seconds, you know, you don't sound right. What's wrong? And, you know, I told him what I did. And he said, listen, I don't know how or this is going to turn out. But, you know, I'll be with you every step of the way. So just try and stay calm. And the relationship between me and my father is portrayed really well in the movie. And you'll see that. And that's what makes it so important to me, that, you know, it really shows the choices and it shows how important family is.
Now that is a great parent, right?
Yes, no doubt.
Because your kids aren't going to be perfect. They're going to make mistakes. What are you going to do when they do? Even if it's...
Right, and I made a mistake in front of the whole world. I embarrassed not only myself, but them. So for them to do what they did and stand by me the way they did is something that I'm very, very grateful for.
Yeah, I'm actually feeling the emotion on that one right now. That's a big-time dad right there. Let me ask you a couple questions on the court before you go here, Tim, and we're all looking forward to seeing the movie Inside Game. Well, number one, you're on the court in the Malice in the Palace. If you could rewind back to that night and do something different so that doesn't happen, was there anything that you could have done that, you know, we could have avoided Ben Wallace and Ron Artest and the whole thing?
As a referee, there's always something you can do when a situation like that exists. I had grabbed Ron Artest and tried to hold on to him from, you know, going up into the stands. I think if I would have gotten to him a little bit sooner and maybe tried to talk to him before he ran up there, it could have avoided that whole situation, because that's when it escalated to the next level. So, you know, looking back, you know, I should have probably got to him sooner.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Ron's a crazy man, but he's also a very likable guy at the same time, correct?
Absolutely. You know, like I just said in a lot of these interviews I'm doing, people don't realize that when the players go onto the court, their adrenaline and their competitiveness gets the best of them, and they really turn into somebody that they're not off the court. So, you know, the competitive nature really spills out into a lot of these sporting events.
Would you say that about Rasheed Wallace, who waited in a parking lot to kick your ass?
Absolutely, I would 100%.
Really?
I've talked to him, yes. I've talked to him since this whole thing went down, and it shocked me with how well he treated me and how the well wishes came out of his mouth, and I can tell that he was truly sincere. And this is a guy that I squared up the fist fight with, and he was fined $1 million and suspended. So for him to do that, you know, it just shows you what type of character he has.
He was fined $1 million for the parking lot fight. Is that right?
Yeah, because he was suspended, I believe, for 7 games. It was the longest suspension ever given at the time, and it cost him well over $1 million.
And when did he come and apologize to you about it?
I did a radio interview in Charlotte, and he was one of the co-hosts of the radio show. And,
wow.
And we had talked on there, and then he called me afterwards. He couldn't have been nicer.
Wow. Go Sheed. So a guy like that, he's super competitive on the court, and he can't let it go for a while after. And so he's still steaming in the parking lot. But years after, he's good, basically.
Yeah, he was a complete gentleman, and I couldn't have been more grateful and appreciative for everything he said to me.
Let me go back into the league offices here. How does... we'll go back in the day, David Stern, or now, I don't know if you believe that, Adam Silver and company. I'm sure that the NBA has an agenda that they want. How do they convey that to the referees going into a game where you end up having a, you know, back in the day, a Lakers-Sacramento situation or something now where everyone thinks that the NBA wants these teams in the finals? I don't know if you believe that. I think you believe that still goes on. I'm curious how the message gets sent down.
Absolutely. What they do is they put referees in a room and they show them tapes of previous games of the teams that are playing that night. And they point specific things out that they want those referees to call that night. And it always is putting a team at an advantage or a disadvantage. And we as referees knew that and would walk out of those meetings shaking our heads saying, you know, geez, they want the Lakers to win tonight or they want Dallas to win tonight. So it's the way they program and train the referees, especially in the playoffs, of what to go out and look for. And because they're being graded on that, you know, the referees go out and do it.
Now, my question on that is, why would the NBA risk, you know, having one playoff matchup, total drop in the bucket, versus, you know, a huge scandal coming out? Wouldn't they think, you know what, look, if we don't get the Lakers in the finals, that's going to suck this year, we're going to lose some money, but grand scheme of things, no big deal.
Well, you know, when David Stern did an interview, it's a famous interview he did on national TV when the reporter said to him, you know, what's your favorite matchup that could take place in the NBA finals this year?
Right, Lakers,
with a smirk on his face, he said the Lakers versus the Lakers.
Right.
And, you know, we knew that that was important, and it's the bottom line. And Dick Bavetta, who was our top referee on the staff at the time, said he was the NBA's go-to guy, that he was put on certain games to have a certain outcome. And, you know, I never forgot that. And a lot of times where I passed information along, it had to do with Dick Bavetta.
See, I hated Dick Bavetta growing up, Tim, because I was a Bulls fan, and they would play the Pistons, and I swear to God, he wanted Detroit to win. And I know Michael Jordan had issue with Dick Bavetta.
Michael Jordan had a summer camp, I'm sure you're aware of it, for you know, young men to play in, and some of the referees would go to that camp and officiate for him. And he would tell them, you know, during breaks, you know, what's up with Dick Bavetta? We all know he cheats. You know, when he's in our games, we just hope he's cheating for us that night. So it's not like the players didn't know, you know, that certain things were going on.
Yeah, I'm just rewinding back. And, you know, Michael wasn't quite Michael at that point. We're talking late 80s. You know, they hadn't won a title yet. But I would still think the league would have wanted Chicago and the Bulls versus Detroit. But it wasn't going on.
Yeah, it wasn't going on at that time. And you never know what the agenda was at that time or what the rating situation is. But, you know, it always just seems that they want that big market team to get in. And sometimes they program and train the referees, the referee, the names on the front and the back of the jerseys, rather than enforcing the rules as they're written in the rule book. And that's where they get in trouble. And that's when their fan base starts to see that it's more of a form of entertainment than a competitive natured sport.
Right. I don't know if you agree with this line of thinking too, but my idea is that, look, you can have as big a scandal as you want. Pete Rose baseball, steroids baseball, gambling, Tim Donaghy basketball. Fans are addicted to the sport, to the games, to the action. None of it matters. They will forget it the next day because they love watching the game and they love to gamble. So I don't even think there's a scandal that could knock sports off the pedestal because we are just that addicted to it.
No doubt about it. I think when you look at that and how gambling is just taking over now, it's going to even just become more of a billion-dollar business each year for a lot of these sporting teams because you're going to be doing interactive gambling from your seat in every arena in the next couple of years where even though it's a 20-25-point blowout, you're staying in your seat because you want to see if James Harden hits his 10th three-pointer because you have the over and you just bet $1,000 for it. So there's going to be a lot of ways that the NBA is going to capitalize from this moving forward, and they're going to need to do it because it seems like they're just having, you know, revenue loss from the China situation. So they're going to be very, you know, competitive and come up with ways that they can take a part of the action and profit from it.
A lot agreed there, Tim, that you're naming, because the NBA is fine. They don't need China's money, right? I mean, it's not like the league's going away. Guys are making $30 million, Jaylen Brown, who, nice player, but come on. Why not on some level not want to ski behind 15 yachts? And, you know, one yacht's good enough. I can water ski right here.
Well, you know, the prices of these NBA franchises have gone through the roof, so they have to continue to bring that revenue in to capitalize on it. And I think that you're never going to stop. You're always going to try to find new revenue streams. And that's just the way the business world is. You want to make that bottom line grow each and every year, and the NBA is no different.
Okay. Where does Tim Donaghy go from here?
Tim Donaghy goes tonight to the film festival in Los Angeles, California, and watches another episode of Inside Game and does some questions and answers. Afterwards, jumps on a plane tomorrow and goes back to his four beautiful daughters and continues to try to be the best parent, best person he can be.
And did I hear you say you're doing real estate on the side? Or is that part
of
your deal?
Yes, I do a little bit of real estate, some work with RefPicks.com, and a lot of marketing for this movie that I believe has a really great message and Inside Game, and I think it's a great learning experience for everybody that watches it.
And where will people be able to see the movie?
It'll be in 30 NBA cities throughout the country, and you know, once it opens up, I believe it's going to spread out you know, into some of the smaller cities, but for now we're in the 30 NBA cities, and you know, it's going to open up November 1st throughout the country.
Awesome. All right, Tim, last one before you go. Michael Jordan is my hero. If you walked down the street and shot someone, I would say he did it in self-defense. So please tell me one Michael Jordan story that I will remember and enjoy.
Well, I don't have a Michael Jordan story, but how about if I hit you with a Dennis Rodman Chicago Bulls story?
Sure.
Dennis Rodman's warming up, and after each layup, he's coming back and standing near me, getting back in line. He's putting both hands down his pants, and he's scratching his nuts like crazy. He does this five times. Finally, after the fifth time, I said to him, Dennis, what are you doing? And he looked at me. He says, Tim, I had almonds for lunch, and it flared up my herpes. And what I'm thinking is, Dennis Rodman's going to get 15 rebounds tonight, touching the ball, then I'm going to have to touch all night, and it just kind of grossed me out.
That's unbelievable. He had the almonds for lunch, and he's busting out that he's got the herp going on, and he tells the referee. Yeah. What did you even say back to him?
I had my jaw dropped, and all I kept thinking was there better be a lot of towels underneath this basket so I can wipe down this ball in my hands every time I touch it.
Did you like Dennis, or was he a big pain in the ass?
Loved him. I loved him. He was a good guy, played hard, and you know, really never, didn't give the refs you know, too many problems.
Did you? I'm trying to think back your time, 94 to 07. So you never ref Lambeer, correct?
Lambeer was my first year. I gave him one technical foul in the second preseason game I had refereed. So I did referee him for 1 year.
I still hate that guy. What would you say?
He's a tough guy. Yeah, he's a tough guy. Played dirty, and you know, was somebody you love to be on the floor with as a teammate and hated to play against.
Who was your least favorite guy to ref?
You know, Rasheed Wallace, because every time I went out on the floor, it was a problem. Yeah. And, you know, you were just ready for that. And we used to bet in the locker room $20 a guy to see who would be the first person to give him a technical foul.
But you appreciate Sheed. Now, who are you still maybe sort of holding a little bit of a grudge against?
Nobody. I have no room in my life for that. You know, I'm hoping people are, you know, not holding grudges against me and continue to look at me and understand I made some poor choices and made some mistakes. So, I don't have animosity towards anybody.
Fair enough. Let me ask it a different way. Who did you ref that committed 17 million fouls and never thought they once fouled anyone?
Rasheed. He never thought he could whack somebody against the head. He could be bleeding from his nose, and he starts screaming and cursing at you like, you know, why are you calling this? I didn't touch him.
Sheed was a beauty. Tim, yes. Great to talk to you. Best of luck with the movie. I'm looking forward to watching it, Inside Game, and thanks for sharing so much today. And on the way out here, props to your dad, Mr. Donnie. You are you're a star. Thanks so much.
I appreciate it. Thanks, pal.
That was fun talking with Tim Donaghy. Looking forward to seeing the movie. All right, let's wrap up. My final thoughts. And yes, I'm going to talk about the quarterback of the Chicago Bears and the head coach, Matt Nagy. A lot of Bears fans are turning on Nagy right now. I happen to not be one of those people. I don't have a huge issue with the fact that he didn't run the ball for three more yards to set up the kicker. And I don't like the I don't think he was right, but I don't like the philosophy, but I'm not going to kill him for it. And maybe the Bears need somebody else calling plays other than Matt Nagy. I'm open to that as well. But the biggest issue with the Bears is the quarterback. Let's not get it twisted. Mitchell Trubisky, mid-30s now, as far as games started in the NFL. He cannot play. He'll make a great throw. He will. And he'll show some elusiveness, too. It'll be impressive. He'll pick up a first down. He'll get you into field goal range to win the game, which he did on Sunday. But he's proven over and over again that he's not consistent and that he's not a franchise quarterback, which you most times need to win a Super Bowl. So, one of the key things in life is to move on when you know it's not working. And the Bears and Trubisky are never going to work. And the Bears, Ryan Pace, specifically, has to look in the mirror and say, you know what? Let's revisit how I got this wrong when I drafted him over Patrick Mahomes and I drafted him over Deshaun Watson. Let me look in the mirror here. What were my biases? What was I seeing? I'm going to take this as a learning experience, and I'm moving forward. That's all you can do. General managers are not perfect, and Ryan Pace has done a lot of good things, but this was a swing and a miss. And so do you keep standing in the same – you're not going to leave the batter's box, so to speak, but this guy can no longer be a part of the equation. So how long will the Bears hold on? Maybe it's the rest of this year. You're not making the playoffs at this point. You're 3-4. It would take a miracle. So maybe you let Mitch play and perhaps open up the offense even more and see if a miracle could happen. Might as well. Playing Chase Daniel makes no sense. But at the end of the year, you have to be aggressive and move forward, and perhaps even before the end of the year. I don't know. Do you want Nick Foles? If I was the Jacksonville Jaguars, I'd stick with Gardner Minshew, and I'd be happy to get Nick Foles' contract off my books. Unlikely that that would happen. But in the offseason, Phillip Rivers, Jameis Winston, Cam Newton, those names don't excite me, but something along those lines has to happen, and you got to move forward. It's okay, Ryan Pace. Made a mistake. It happens. Going to hurt the franchise for a long time, but you still have to move forward. And moving forward, subscribe, like, give a rating to On The Mark, tell a friend, as the podcast coming out every Monday afternoon. Thanks to David Ross. Thanks to Tim Donaghy. And most importantly, thank you for listening. This has been On The Mark with yours truly, Mark Harmon.